We've been moving this past month through talking about each of the five ethical precepts from the early Buddhist tradition. We've talked about them out of order, so I think we did them in the order 3, 2, 4, 5, 1, for whatever reason. Kind of start with sex and move on to everything else, basically. And it's actually lovely. I've never done it before to end a sequence of talking about the precepts with the first one. Usually it's like the first one, roughly we think of it as the precept on non-harming. We think of it as the basis of all the others. So in a way, having looked at a lot of details around action in the world, how we move with the various energies of property and gift, sexuality, speech, intoxicants, looking at how action in the world, how what we do here, is always relational. Looking at all these kind of manifestations of action, then coming to this first kind of foundational precept or guideline for action. And the word that we know as non-harming, ahimsa, is the Sanskrit word primarily used in the yoga tradition, and it's the first precept generally in most of the lists of precepts in yoga. The word in the Buddhist version is not ahimsa, but the chant starts with the word panatipata, which is more literally not non-harming, but not taking life. So I want to talk specifically about a way that we can understand this basic ethical or action guideline as turning our attention toward the quality of aliveness itself as something precious. That at the very beginning of the path, the Buddha says, you know, almost like it's the first practice, really, once after one has taken refuge. The practice of the precepts, and it's the practice that is shared by all the monastics and the lay community, everyone who aligns themselves with the tradition. And it says to abstain from or avoid taking life. And that seems very simple. And it turns out to be impossible, like all the precepts. So in a certain way, that's a good thing, because as soon as a task is impossible, failure is also impossible. So this is good, right? As soon as success is impossible, failure is also impossible. And that's freeing. What we're left with then is not something that one can succeed at or fail at, although your inner sense that you might be succeeding or failing could be alive and well. I grew up Catholic. My mind certainly is alive and well. And I mention growing up Catholic because I understand how a core ethos of correct or incorrect action leading to judgment, leading to salvation or damnation, is deep in my bones and deep in the bones of my culture, even if I no longer believe in that model, whatever that means. That the idea that our actions would be judged is almost like in our DNA, many of us, not all, but many, depending on what your origin culture is. But there's no judge in the Buddhist system. Or to make it more challenging, there is a judge, but it's just you. Judging yourself, mostly poorly or unskillfully. So then what does it mean, these precepts? The precept is to abstain from taking life. And we can flip it into the positive and say this is the guideline to protect life or save life. As we've been doing with all the precepts, let's just kind of name a few areas where the the guideline may be active. And generally, we've been looking at the personal, the interpersonal, the societal, and maybe even the sort of planetary. We'll certainly get to the planetary with this one very quickly. The literal teachings in some of the earliest versions of this precept are in a certain way very basic. You know, don't kill living beings, the text says. So that's fairly straightforward. And you know, in many, for many folks who practice, you know, folks will take on the practice of trying not to intentionally take the life of any being, you know, to, for a long time, like what we would have a classic kind of, it's hot and then it rains, sort of ant explosion inside. I would have a little soft broom and dustpan. I would sort of dustpan up, you know, thousands of squirming ants and take them outside and sort of knock them off into a sort of confused pile. Because, of course, they're totally confused once you take them off their path. Maybe they might even just, like, wander off and die. Like, they're a very organized little unit, the ants. And then I would be sad for the few that, you know, got smushed in the scooping up. So that's one aspect of this practice. But I don't emphasize that aspect in a way, partly because I think it's not, it might be a little delusional to think that if I'm doing that, I'm really observing this precept. I think it's a fine thing to do, like you know, protect the lives of the little ants if we can. But it goes deeper than this. In some Buddhist countries, this precept is considered to imply the choice to be vegetarian. Certainly, for some particularly Chinese Buddhists, this precept is the root of vegetarianism. But for most of the Asian Buddhist world, especially for the monastics, this precept does not mean being vegetarian. Specifically because the monastics operate under a gift economy that supersedes all other rules. And so if you're begging for your meal, the ethical guideline actually that's important for the functioning of the entire system is to take whatever's offered and to eat whatever the people around you are eating. So then, of course, that includes meat. And sometimes idealistic Westerners are shocked to go to Burma or Thailand and find all of the monks and nuns eating meat. But it's actually quite culturally coherent to do so. And the precept, in line with the teachings on how karma is accrued, how the effects of actions stick to one, primarily talks about the intentional causing of harm or death. This has led to some creative sort of legal maneuvering in parts of Buddhist Asia, where devout Buddhists would never kill an insect, and so would sort of, you know, go to the fish market where the live fish are swimming around, and the fishmonger would say, you know, which fish do you want? And the shop, the Buddhist layperson shopping would say, oh, no, no, you know, I can't cause the death of a living being. I'm a Buddhist. So, you know, I'm just passing by, you know, and the shopkeeper say, oh, I understand. I so respect that. That's such an honorable tradition. Which one do you think is the nicest anyway? And, you know, just, and the person would say, oh, well, that one over there is definitely the nicest. You know, have a good day. Bye bye. And the shopkeeper, you know, might come running down the street a bit later and say, oh, it you know, died of natural causes. Now, I'm repeating that story, having heard it from my teachers. I don't actually know its provenance. Like, this could be totally, probably exaggerated. But it points for us to, you know, a curious paradox. And actually, of course, it points to the economy quite quickly, right? I don't kill beings, but my butcher kills them. right? In a classical Buddhist sense, the butcher accrues the karma, not me. Most Western practitioners that I know don't find that logic convincing. Partly because we are a little more hip to the effects of our actions on a global scale in economic exchange, right? You know that if you buy fill-in-the-blank thing cheaply from fill-in-the-blank despicable cheap, you know, corporation, that it was made in fill-in-the-blank despicable conditioned sweatshop in impoverished country somewhere, right? And the details of that are endemic, so you could fill in the blanks with almost anything. So to come back to the personal. The traditional instructions are simply not to kill beings. So it's almost a way that for many of us in a non-agrarian or non hunting-based and non-aggression-based or war-based community, it's almost like, well, I don't kill many beings. You know, it's easy enough to not kill the insects intentionally. And beyond that, I find folks kind of, in a certain way, not think about this one too much. Like, okay, so I don't kill things. Like, but instantly, if we go further than that, we reach the truth of our bodies in an ecosystem. So, you know, the old argument that a defensive meat eater makes to a militant vegan, you know, is that the carrot is also alive and cries out in its carrot way when plucked from Mother Earth. To which Thomas Merton said, you know, everything is alive, but I eat carrots rather than cows because the cows scream louder. Mm-hmm. So there's that. Everything is alive. And to be embedded in an ecosystem means being embedded in, you know, the food chain. So a couple tidbits to sort of confuse your sense of what killing living beings means. One is that a percentage that I read recently that I'm now just sort of fluffing, but it was something like, you know, 80% of the cells that make up my body have different DNA than me. In other words, they're bacteria and microbes, and they're creatures, they're living beings. Viruses and, you know, helpful symbiotic, you know, things that I don't think of as not me, right? We think of like, oh, that this body and what's in it is me, you know, and then, and then I eat my yogurt and I, you know, I eat billions of bacteria of a certain kind, or I get a little sick. And, you know, I take an antibiotic and just, like, you know, bacterial genocide happens in my body, right? I'm traveling in India being a strict vegetarian, taking care not to step on insects, but I take a drop of grapefruit seed extract, you know, in the morning in my water to not get sick. And I'm just slaughtering, you know, bacterial beings. So this is funny in a certain way because it's absurd, right? We're like, well, yeah, you know, you can't actually isolate yourself from the ecosystem in a way that you could say, oh, well, now I'm not, you know, taking the life of any living beings, right? The microbes that are. But while funny, like, the point is actually profound if we expand out from the microbiome to the macrobiome and recognize that every moment's engagement with aliveness is an engagement with life and death. So as we breathe in the biome and the beings that live in the air. As we breathe out different beings. As we eat anything, we take in all of the living things and we change its form. Right? We kill, perhaps, the carrot, the kale, the egg, the milk, the chicken, whatever we eat. And then larger than that, you know, the food that we eat, but also, you know, we burn the fuel and we, you know, keep the houses warm and we chop down the trees and we grow new ones and we mine the earth. And really, you can do a... you might sometime... I did this when I first started getting into actually trying to figure out what my footprint was on the planet and my the sort of degrees of separation. Do a little mind map where you put yourself at the center and around you, you put your things, right? Even just a few things, you know, like a pair of Levi's jeans, you know, with cotton from where? So then it's cotton, an object, and a place. And who grew it? And how did it get here? And what are the conditions? And, you know, and that for all of the items that I wear, there's both the sort of ecosystem material that they're made out of, and then there's the human material that brought them to us. And then there's sort of what I wear, what I eat, what I live in, how I move around. And as you make this map, you know, very quickly, it's an impossible map to make. Like, you could take any one thing, one thread in this shirt, not even the shirt itself, but like one thread, and trace that thread out into starlight, right? Quite quickly. Where does silk come from? Worms. In worm farms somewhere, right? Right? You have something that's made out of silk. It's a marvelous fabric. What is silk? Right? It's a thing that a particular worm spins and dies in the process, you know? Like, so you tug on any thread of the fabric of life and the whole thing vibrates. And this is one of the most profound, in a way, reflections of the Buddhist system that came to be called the Great Turning or the Great Vehicle, the Mahayana, the Great Way, which was the reflection on interdependence, or the word that the beautiful teacher Thich Nhat Hanh uses, interbeing, that our being in no way can be isolated as individual, but that our being is absolutely interwoven with other beings, and actually with all other beings. So that no one is, but everything inter is, or we inter are. And I like the sort of the words that get created when you try to say this. And very quickly, that reflection. So this is a materialist reflection on just like, where does stuff come from and what is the harm caused? As I just go about my as simple as I can make it, but still quite complex modern life. That very quickly we get to not just harm caused, but we just get to relationship in all directions. That everything is relationship. And that I have a relationship with millions of beings, billions of beings, if we go beyond the human and animal. In a very direct way, in everything that comes into contact with me. And of course, the great, almost like the most intense manifestation of interconnectedness on this planet that's happening right now is man-made climate change. Where our desire for a set of comforts, like transportation and warmth, and our technologies, energy primarily, has given rise to a situation that may at this point be unstoppable and may irrevocably change the planet. is already changing the planet in ways that we can't go back on. And that in a way, our individual presence in it is almost, and this is frustrating, almost sort of hopelessly inconsequential. Like, you could drop out, and I know good hippies who have done this, and gone to a homesteading island off the coast of a distant coast, and lived by, you know, milling the trees on your own land to build your house, and bringing water from a rain-filled creek, and asking no energy from the rest of the world. No power plant supplies your energy. You know. One of my friends who lives there turns old, like no longer working, like kind of motors salvaged from old machines, into tiny hydropower generators that can be submerged in a creek no more than a few inches deep. Right? Like, this is somebody who's like, I can take the junk of industrial life and turn on lights with it so that we don't draw any more pain from the world than we already have. But in a way, like, all of us and everyone we know and everyone they know could try to do that, and the whole world would continue to go in the direction it's going. Not because our actions are inconsequential, but because the system is so huge. And more deeply, maybe, from a Buddhist perspective, that it's actually not possible to leave. This is one of the, I think, chilling things to be not in denial about in a system that promises liberation. I think a lot of us, and I feel a thread of this in myself, hold a kind of fantasy that liberation or enlightenment or realization means that somehow I get to leave the messy place and no longer be responsible for it. And when the Buddha was asked, where do enlightened beings go? He said, it's not the right question. They neither go nor don't go anywhere. They're different from anything else, but they're not anything that you can imagine that they are. But if we let go of the fantasy that liberation means we leave, we go somewhere else, then we have to land back in the admission that we're always embedded, that we're always completely in the system. Right? The Buddha ate the food of his ecosystem. He participated in the politics of his time and place for his whole life. So the reflection on not taking life. Suggests to us that it's of foundational importance for the path of liberation and our own well-being to turn away from actions that we know cause harm. And then as soon as we reflect on it, we realize that it's essentially impossible to do so. What this suggests, I think, is that it's not the material reality of harm caused or not caused that is the important piece. It's important. Like if every day you're, you know, killing, it would be awesome if you figured out how to not do that, right? As dramatically. But that actually the place that the practice exists is in the heart, but particularly in the way that we that killing or harming beings happens when we feel ourselves as separate from them. When we think or we get lost in the illusion of separateness or isolation, it's easy to feel threatened by the other, to grasp at or fear the other, to harm the other. So then a reflection comes up, you know, if I reflect on, you know, myself being embedded in the biome, in the ecosystem, how is it different to care for a cut on my leg by washing it and sheltering it so that it heals? And to care for, say, a scar on a piece of land that I tend by taking care of erosion and replanting? And if that makes sense to you, then how is it different to care for the people in my city? And outward, as far as you can imagine, to care for the world. So here's a challenging thought experiment from the utilitarian ethicist Peter Singer. It goes like this. You've put your entire life savings into a car, a tremendously fabulous car. That's going to appreciate over time, and so it's essentially your retirement. You're driving it around. It stalls on a railroad track. The train is coming. If the train hits the car, right, you could get out of the car, but you're going to lose all of your savings. Just down the way a bit, the track splits into a Y. And the lever to switch the tracks is near you. So you could change it so the train goes on the other track and avoids your car, saving your investment. But then you notice that walking on the other track is a young child. And you shout to the child to move, but the child is deaf and can't hear you. Or the wind is high or something. The child doesn't hear you. So then you have the lever in your hand and you can choose where the train is going to go. What do? Right? You save the child and sacrifice your car, probably. I mean, I don't know you, but you know. The idea in the thought experiment is that it's obvious what you would do when it's life versus property, right? So then Singer says, this is happening all the time. Is it different when you can't see the child? Or when the child is of a different race or class or family system than you? Because, of course, that child lives on your street, basically, right? And all over the world. What is it that prevents us from using all of our resources, as much of our resources as we can, to save lives? So that's just there to trouble the water, right? Because it's impossible to save all of the children, right? The thing that's flawed about the model is that there's not just one Y, but there's about 7 billion of them, and you have actually just one tiny little car. And so there's a kind of hopelessness also built into the system. If the thing that you hinge success on is saving everyone, this comes up against, right, the great truth of the inevitability of death. And I think this first precept touches immediately into the reality of both, that birth and death is just real, right? What does it mean to protect life in the face of inevitable loss? Does it mean to just sustain it as long as we can? You know, elders choosing to die at the time they prefer rather than live in pain. So many examples of how our intention to preserve life runs into the very real systemic weave between life and death, between birth and death. So then the last reflection, in a certain way, for this evening, for this little talk, is to return to the Mahayana, the great vehicle, and take the understanding of what's happening in the microbiome, in the body, and interconnection or interexistence with others to its natural conclusion, which is that it becomes difficult to isolate a particular essential experience or quality and call it myself separate from anything else. Where do these thoughts and concepts come from? I learned them, right? They're part of actually the cultural mind. Where did the body come from, right? I just made a body. So it's pretty clear that it comes from, you know, a little teeny bit of me and a whole lot of milk, you know? And it just keeps getting bigger. You know, you just give it little bits of yam and milk and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It's amazing. But where is it coming from, really? Like, what is it? The baby's body. Is it a new self? Because, of course, I'm giving him a self also. I'm being like, this is your name, and these are the names of things. This is what we like to do. Right? I'm creating his personality, you know. What of it is his, and what of it is created? What of you is you? And what is actually the property of the ecosystem that you think is yours? So then the teaching on the emptiness of the self, the lack of a certainty about individual separate identity, is actually the same mystery as the question of ethical action in relation to everything being connected. If everything is connected, you are also everything. That's sort of the punchline, right? Once you are everything, what is life and death? What is taking life mean now? In the Zen tradition that I grew up in, meaning in my early 20s, before I came to the early Buddhist tradition, this first precept was phrased like this: to not fall into the mind of extinction is to observe the first precept of not killing. And part of what it meant was to not believe for a moment that there could be such a thing as a being who could be born or die. As soon as there are no such things as separate beings, there's no such thing as killing separate beings. Right? This is the dangerous kind of transcendent lurking in the room. So we'll just sort of toss that out there. Right? Nothing exists in the way that we think it does. Therefore, action in relation to things is not what we think it is. But the precept still stands. Protect life as the foundation of practice. So there's a bit of the mystery of that, hopefully clear, or maybe just a little bit confusing, once we get to vast emptiness. Let's take some time to hear some other voices, include your reflections, How do you understand the practice or the challenge of working with our actions as they harm or help beings? What are the places that it really flows for you, or that it's hard for you, this embedded existence?
I have a garden.
Yeah.
So I have a vegetable garden, and I have things that I don't want, mm-hmm. beans I don't want in my garden, because they eat my food.
Yeah.
And that's one of those places where I really struggle. You know, I try to grow, part of me is like, I'll grow extra for everyone, but there's certain things that are not...
You can't feed all the cabbage moths in the world.
I cannot feed all the cabbage moths in the world. It's true. Or the slugs, mm-hmm. or, you know. So I try to minimize it.
Yeah.
And feed it back into the soil. If I kill a snail, I dig it under.
Totally.
You know. But that's where I find myself on a pretty regular basis.
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely. And if we take seriously the paradox of it, right, and not fall into the mind of guilt, that somehow it should be able to be otherwise, because it's not, right, then, like, what does that do for you and your relationship with the land you tend to understand, because you understand how the system works, right? What happens in your practice when that's true?
I feel more part of the ecosystem in the world is when I can wrap my brain around it, that it's like, you know, we are all part of this larger thing.
Yeah.
And someday I will be soil food, I'll be compost.
For sure.
One way or another.
For sure.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you see it that way, or the understanding of that is present, how's the feeling different?
It's fuller.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
I was thinking about, like, not taking, when you said something along the lines of not taking the aliveness of something, that made me think of my mom and one of her cats right now, and the cat has this physical problem that's really difficult, and it's genetic, and she's been trying to keep the cat comfortable, but it's getting, like, worse and painful, and she was talking about how she feels like she might just make the decision to put the cat to sleep, and I just thought about that, and it's kind of along the lines of what you were saying, elders choosing when to die instead of live in pain. But then, like, the choice of, you know, something that you're taking care of or someone that you're taking care of, like, making the choice for them to stop living, like, that seems like it is like, when I think about that, it does make me feel like closer to it, like, more deeply aware of how deeply integrated I am in, you know, just life in general, and the necessity of death and all of that.
Yeah.
But then also there's like this cognitive dissonance of, you know, wanting to do what is least harmful and not knowing if that is least harmful, especially with an animal that can't tell you what it wants.
Of course.
You know.
What a hard... I mean, of course, that's always one of the hardest decisions to make, isn't it? I think I respect and appreciate, or I hold almost as, like, the important thing practice-wise here is the cognitive dissonance of it. Like, that's the important part. Like, you'll take care of the cat as best you can and make a hard decision. You know. Either way, the cat dies eventually. Either way, there's some pain. So then you figure it out. But for the practice of it, in terms of, like, how we mature toward understanding more and more deeply our place in the system, I think the dissonance is really important to not try to solve with a facile answer. Mm-hmm. Like, oh yeah, I get it. It's just this and that. You know, not to make it easy, actually, mm-hmm. but to let it stay hard and kind of achy in the heart. Feels really important. And then you're like, right. Because we're making that choice all the time. You know, like all of our choices impact beings, you know, in less direct ways. So, when you stay with the sort of the dissonance of it, like you just hang out with, like that's true. What's it like?
Well, I'm just getting emotional. It's not just the cat and people, but I think about, you know, other hard decisions that involve like other people feeling pain and or myself feeling pain and wanting to find that simple one-line answer or solution, you know, to fix it, but then really knowing it's not something to fix. There's no actual problem. It's just
there's reality doing its thing.
Yeah. So.
And the emotion is what? When it gets emotional, what's the feeling?
It's like I guess it's like a hue of just there's a feeling of helplessness, but not really helplessness. Like maybe we're like more like overwhelm or like awe, like just kind of.
Yeah, that's an interesting. Actually, the sequence that you just said.
Oh.
That the first thing you said was helplessness, which has a kind of disempoweredness to it.
Yeah.
And then overwhelm, which in a certain way is a little bit different. You're in relation to a vast force that you can't overcome. It's different from helplessness. And then awe really kind of just opens it all the way out. Right. And maybe some of the practice there that I think is beautiful practice is like, what are the stages of feeling that we go through when we come into intimate contact with something that real or with reality in any particular way, you know? And the thing about reality is that we can't, you know, make it be the way we want.
Yeah.
So when we come into contact, what do we do? And I think that sequence is actually a beautiful kind of teaching. Like the first thing I feel is helpless, which is, that's the ego's response in some way. I'm used to feeling effective, like, oh yeah, I got that. It's just, you know, the bill comes, you pay it. You know, it's just like hitting the volley back on the court.
Yeah.
You know, but then reality actually, you know, is that your racket has no strings, and there's a hail of balls coming, in billions of them, right? And you're like, so, something like that. That.
Pretty accurate.
Right? Seriously. And then, of course, the practice is not to figure out how to hit any balls at all, but to let go of the illusion that the game is to hit the balls back. Right? That, like, oh, that's an idea I have that I'm supposed to, like, you know, whoops, did that one. Okay, well, who's next? You know, and, like, you know, I'm Jackie Chan in the middle of a field of 50, or, you know, I'm Neo in the field of 50 Agent Smiths, and they just keep coming. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that scene at the end is actually how it is. Like, it's the thing that destroys it as an action movie. Mm-hmm. We're in the Matrix now. So, if you didn't see it, right, throughout the course, the early part of the movie, it's a standard sort of good guy fighting against bad guys sort of scene. And the core bad guy is this sort of Agent Smith guy who shows up in many different forms, and sometimes several of him show up. But our hero, you know, dispatches them all with his supernatural kind of, I understand the Matrix, skill. Until he realizes that, until Agent Smith has propagated to take the form of every being on the planet, and there's a fight scene where our hero is dispatching them, but, like, thousands of them are just pouring over the buildings. And it's like, oh, no amount of superhero skill defeats the system. And that's what makes it an existential action movie and not an action movie, right? A romantic action movie, is that the only thing he can do actually is stop fighting, right? And then that turns this, it turns the plot. So what that's that sequence, helpless and then overwhelmed and then something else. And the awe that you made is a beautiful word, right? A kind of like, oh, what happens when it opens up into, oh, reality is like this, you know? And that's a liberating turn if we can land there with our full selves. So that's nice. That's nice. And of course, it's always nice to talk about the Matrix a little bit, you know? Dharma context. Any other reflections? What's in your mind? Please, sorry, Stephanie, behind you, and then.
I always had a question about kind of this idea of liveliness in terms of not just like the physical act of dying and being born, but also like just the feeling of feeling alive.
Yeah.
And I remember it, like, this hit me pretty strongly when I watched the Ken Burns jazz series a few years ago, and they mentioned that what a drummer, Chip Webb, had, like, this debilitating spinal disease.
Mm-hmm.
But he would be out, like, just banging on the drums every night, and then at the end of the day, he'd be, like, in crippling pain and just be at home, you know, sleeping and trying to get better for the next night. And that always, because I was, like, you know, getting into yoga at the time and learning about these concepts of ahimsa and non-harming, and, like, I was just thinking to myself, wow, like, so he could have protected his body and just not played the drums, but then that would be a spiritual type of harm for himself, like, because playing the drums was such an important aspect of his life. And so, yeah, and that's just a question I've kind of held for myself, too, in a lot of ways, and just thinking about, like,
yeah.
You know, what action is actually, like, right in that way in terms of the feeling of liveliness and contributing to that for others.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah. It's a beautiful example, you know. He's kind of a, you know, one of the great saints of self-sacrifice and, you know. But what if the thing that we think of as well-being is actually a kind of delusion? We think well-being is like, I've set up the conditions for my body and my psyche to feel safe for as long as possible. But all of that is based on the delusion of like the possibility of even succeeding at that. Being safe, sustaining, et cetera, security, et cetera. What if well-being actually is being in touch with aliveness as much as possible? So that's just a question, you know. Well, we still have a couple minutes, yeah.
I think never mind.
Really?
I don't know how to make it small enough or contained enough, I think, for the...
I don't know. Try mentioning it, and then if I can't say anything about it, then
okay.
I won't. But I think it's fun for the group just to hear where we go.
So, I guess what's come up for me in this rich discussion is... you've talked a lot about reality. And when I hear you say the word reality, something in me is curious as to... what is real or what that means.
Yeah.
I wonder as to how much reality we assign to much that is not ultimately real, and that's observable.
Yeah.
And how much reality that is ultimately real, which we could call life, which is unable to be killed.
Yes.
It's not, yeah. So So and that
second law of thermodynamics. Which one is it?
I don't know. But yeah. And so and I think it's so oftentimes it's as if that which is ultimately real is overlooked, and there's a greater degree of reality assigned to that which ultimately isn't real.
Yeah.
And it's always a difficult thing to bring that up, because by no means do I want to suggest that it's unimportant in any way how to be in a world that is essentially made up, right? It's made up. It's created.
Yes.
and ultimately destroyed. But I guess for me, what comes up is who, you know, and I would.
Yeah.
Venture to be so bold as to say that it's not you.
Yeah.
And in that, it's easy. It is an easy one-line answer or something to be kind and not be mean when we are, when our murderousness is inescapable.
Yeah.
And so, I guess that's what I had to say.
So. I'm so glad you said that. Absolutely. Absolutely. To be kind, to not be mean when our murderousness is inescapable, when our murderousness is seen to be inescapable. Absolutely, absolutely. The Hindu tradition uses the words real and unreal quite a bit. And some wings of the later Buddhist traditions enter into the great Indian debate about reality and unreality, where that's essentially hinged on the idea that real means a kind of, you know, eternal, unbroken, singular, platonic, essential nature of things, or God, and the unreal is everything fabricated or illusory, you know. The illusion of the clock, when what's actually here is just a temporary conglomeration of plastics, you know, and concepts about time. So that's a whole debate that has a deep kind of provenance in the Indian intellectual imagination. The Buddha didn't do that debate very much. He didn't enter into it, and the early texts don't use the words real and unreal very much. Mostly he would say, it's the wrong question to ask, is something real or not real? He would say, what is its effect? Right? So he would come back to the ethical. What actually happens? He's like, oh, is there suffering? Well, then do something about that. And in a way, like, it doesn't actually matter if the thing that's making you suffer is an illusion, because you're suffering. And the only thing we need to be liberated from is suffering, not from reality or unreality. We don't have to be liberated from illusion. What we want is to not suffer. And that entails liberation from illusion, but that's not the point in a certain way. In some of the other traditions, it's totally the point, right, is to connect with the real, right, which means God, essentially. For the Buddha, there's not a God at the heart of the system. And so then there's not a real, because as soon as you say there's a real, it's essentially another word for God, right? It's an eternal thing. And the Buddha would say, oh, no, that's empty also. Real and unreal is just, we would say, you know, like an unstable dialectic, right? Hey, you know, realness means there's unrealness, therefore neither one is the thing I'm looking for. So that's a short answer to that, is that the place you end with that reflection is the place I would also sort of go with it, which is that, like, there's a danger in getting too excited about transcendent abstraction when what's actually happening is beings in pain that can be met with kindness, you know. So thanks for that. It's awesome. And that's our time. Thank you, everyone, for your presence and for hanging out, talking about existence and action. Having finished this sequence on the five precepts, I'll start something else next week. I'm not sure what it is. But we'll keep exploring. If there's particular things that you're really into exploring, let me know. I'm dreaming about sort of things to do with this group in the future, you know, that are, I don't even know if I can sort of do them, right? That I don't know, we could do a unlearning racism series, you know, or a tantric ritual to prove that you don't exist series or something, you know, like we can go anywhere that we want in deeper practice, but it's been really a pleasure and moving to me that so many of you come again and again to have this conversation and be in this exploration. So thank you for being that. It's really a gift to get to join you and chat about things. So as always, we're fully on the gift economy here. Your donations of your resources absolutely support being able to come here and do this for me and for the studio to offer it. Thank you for your generosity. Donations go in the basket on the shelf there. And take good care. So blessings.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.